Hey, everybody, I'm recording this from my home studio, but I have this new roommate, and she's here all the time. I mean, she's just around all the
time. Hey, Kyone?
Yeah, what is it?
Who are you talking to? You know, I just can't wait to be best friends. I mean, we're roommates now, and that's really, really, really cool, but I just feel like in no time at all, we're just going to be, like, best friends, and I just want to, like, know all about you. Like, what makes you tick?
You know what? I'm the kind of person that just needs a... No, a certain amount of space.
Oh, no, I totally get that. I mean, me too. That's just like one of the million bazillion ways we are like so similar. Oh, my friend Gabe is going to come over. He's a Peruvian and he's a Shining Path Maoist gorilla. And they're not really like super active right now. So he's up here making some money as a waiter and buying hand grenades. And he plays pan flute. Do you like pan flute?
I'm just going to go out for a while. So.
Oh, that's totally perfect. While you're out, can you go pick up some kefir to replace what you drank from my bottle of kefir? I hate to even ask you, but I can't really drink, you know, like regular milk. So I have to get kefir. And then if you drink all of it, then like I run out too fast and I'm just like, what am I going to drink?
First
you know?
Of all, what the f*** is kefir? And second of all, no, I didn't drink it.
Kefir is sort of like milk, but it's like probiotic and totally healthy with like a ton of vitamins. I had this really bad UTI when I was dating this guy, Strider, who you're probably going to meet because we're like semi back together. I mean, like it takes forever for him to text me back, but I keep texting anyway. So anyway, the antibiotics made me like even sicker and I just wasn't getting any better. And then I started drinking kefir and it totally helped. And like, I don't want to accuse you of drinking it all, but I totally know how much kefir I have because it's $3.69 a bottle. And when I checked it today...
Stop!
Oh, are you okay?
Yes, I am going to back slowly out the door, and you can have this apartment, okay? And here are the keys to my car. Just promise me you won't follow me or ever talk to me again.
So we're, like, not gonna be best friends?
The thing is, this is the fifth time this has happened. I have to stop giving them everything I own just to get rid of them. Today our show is about roommates. And now he keeps begging Anthony Weiner to get a place of his own. Colin McEnroe.
Just saying, move on, get on with your life. We have nothing in common. All right, so we are going to talk about roommates today. We're going to talk about them across kind of a spectrum. We're going to start with the college experience, the first time that many of us ever have a roommate. But we're also going to look at a changing demographic, and that is people in their 20s, maybe even their early 30s, who are still having roommates because, of several demographic forces kind of impinging on that. Towards the end of the show, you'll meet a group of roommates called Fortress Astoria. They have been living together in New York City for 18 years. So they've exceeded all actuarial tables there. So, but we're going to start with the college experience. Joining us right now is Dalton Conley. He's a professor at NYU. Recently wrote an op-ed for the New York Times about his freshman college roommate experience. But before we even get to him, we're going to start with Susan Salisbury. She is director of residential life at Trinity College in Hartford. So right now you're watching this drama unfold, right? You're watching a whole bunch of people who don't know anything about one another try to figure out how to live together.
Absolutely. We just welcomed over 600 freshmen to Trinity College last weekend. And of course, immediately, we always have a little bit of drama that is starting to rise. You can't get away from that. We have they're young and
And you know, we were talking before the show started. I mean, one of the demographic trends that impinges on this is the fact that family sizes have been getting smaller. Houses have been getting bigger. So you probably have a larger percentage of incoming college freshmen who have never shared a room with anybody, even a sibling in their lives, right?
Yes, that's very true. We get many students who will actually request to have a single occupancy space, which we discourage, but they insist that they've never, ever had to draw that line down the middle of the room. And it's just part of, you know, growing up and coming to college, which is what we try to explain to them and to their parents that express concern as well.
So first of all, how are roommates assigned to one another? I mean, and do they have, like when I was going to college, freshman year, you had just no say about it. It was the luck of the draw. Is that still that way? You have no say about it?
Yes, the majority of students are randomly placed together. They fill out a residential survey, which is very basic lifestyle questions, and I get to spend the month of July playing matchmaker, We do have students that now, because of Facebook, we have Facebook pages of freshmen, and they get online and they start to meet each other, and they will request if they can live with this person and that person, which we will accommodate that request, reminding them to really have conversations, because once they meet each other, it might not be what they expected. I kind of play the match.com.
And you play matchmaker, but to them, it probably seems like you're playing God. You have so much say over all this. So what do you, I mean, obviously you don't want a smoker with a non-smoker.
Correct.
Or are there some little couple of basic things like that? Is there anything else that you're trying to look for, or are you just hoping for the best?
Basic lifestyles, are they nighttime people? Are they early morning people? Are they, athletes? They're on the crew team. They get up at 5 a.m. What are their study habits? Do they plan on having no guests during the semester? Do they plan to have their entire high school come and visit them? So very basic things like that we look for. And then the rest is, all up to luck and fortune.
We've got a lot of interesting guests on the show today, but we do also welcome your phone calls, 860-275-7266, if there are aspects of the roommate experience you would like to break on off and nibble on in our presence. 860-275-7266. So across the board, as you survey what's going on in other colleges, or I don't know whether you have like an annual symposium or convention or where all you the people who do what you do get together, are there trends, for example, are there trends toward allowing prospective freshman roommates a little bit more flexibility in sort of trying to guide their own destinies in terms of who they get paired up with?
Yes, there are some schools who will actually use roommate matching software. We don't use that. It's all, pen and paper. And more and more colleges will allow students to choose roommates, especially as they do get to meet each other online. But on the other hand, there are many students who say, I don't want to do that. I need to meet new people. This is what I want to do. And which is still the majority of the students just give me the opportunity to get out there and meet them.
It's gratifying to hear. It'll be especially gratifying to Dalton Conley. He's, a professor at NYU, wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times entitled When Roommates Were Random. And so, Dalton Conley, you sort of, based on your own experience anyway, you think that's sort of the way to do it, the way that she says that the majority of people at Trinity anyway seem to want to do it anyway.
Right. We have very few opportunities in our lives where we're really thrown in a intimate situation like sharing a 9x12 space, living space with someone else who we don't know beforehand, and we don't have any control over selecting them. I guess your parents are about the only other ones you don't select. I think it's really a rite of passage, since we don't have universal military service, that you get this experience and you learn how to deal with somebody who may be very different than you. Already colleges are, especially selective colleges, are getting people who are pretty homogenous in terms of age, often in terms of ability and social class. So let's leave a little bit of the randomness left in there. My anecdotal information is that maybe a majority still want to throw themselves to the random roommate generator. However, a rapidly rising minority are going on to Facebook or to Roombug or these other websites and pre-selecting your roommates and kind of bypassing that whole serendipitous process. And I think there's something lost. We gain control, but we lose something in the process.
Well, and you say, talking in your essay about your own experience of having to accommodate yourself and learn to communicate with somebody who was really different from you. Just in a nutshell, give people a sense of that.
Yeah, I mean, I went to school in California, and my roommate was a conservative Republican, son of a judge that had been appointed by Ronald Reagan when he was governor. I came from the liberal bastions of New York City's Greenwich Village and Lower East Side, and so we had very different political views and cultural frames, and that was a very interesting part of my education at college, to be put with somebody who was had different views on the issues of the day and just style of life than I had. He was a member of a fraternity, I wasn't, and so forth. So it's one of the ways you get exposed to new ideas, and we know that a lot of the kind of peer learning that happens on campus doesn't happen in classrooms, and that's the equal importance of a residential college experience.
Those are great points. So, Susan Salisbury, you know, you encounter probably all kinds of complaints or objections or, you know, I can't possibly room with this person because he or she is X. And there are probably some of them where you, based on your instinct, based on your years of experience, think, you know what, you're going to get past that. You know, that's probably not going to be a deal breaker. And there are probably some other ones that are just giant red flags. Could you give us a sense of those things? He talked about political beliefs. I don't know. I'm a vegan. He's a steak eater. I mean, what are the things that are manageable differences, and what are the differences where you think, uh-oh, we're going to do something about this?
One of the complaints that comes up the most is schedules. You know, students that get up very early and they're living with someone who is rocking until 3 o'clock in the morning, very manageable. Trying to get them to talk to each other is one of the biggest challenges we have. God forbid they have to sit down and actually face each other and talk to each other. And these kinds of things, as you say, you know, the vegetarian versus the person who's bringing half a cow into the room to eat. And then there are the red flags. The student that walks in drunk most of the time, vomiting in the bed. These are the issues that we really need to work with the students on. And there are, for the most part, maybe, you know, the couple that we have to find another living situation and, you know, deal with something like that. So those are doesn't happen that often, but unfortunately, we can count on something like that happening every fall.
You know, Dalton Connolly, as you're listening to this, I mean, it is true. I had a sort of similar experience to you in that my college roommate and I were, you know, from pretty different backgrounds. I actually did. He was very straight-laced. And as Susan is saying this, I'm aware that on our maybe third night, I had my first serious experience with tequila. And I did sort of come home, open up the window, and throw up onto College Street in New Haven. Very much alarming, Ken. But, you know, we can romanticize these kinds of differences, too. And I'm... As you got even reactions to your piece in the Times, as you thought about it a little bit more, is there any part of you that's sort of tempered by that, sort of thinking, wow, you know, maybe there's something to be said for at least having a little bit of – there's so much anxiety about the freshman year of college anyway.
It sounds to me like you were the perfect roommate. You were polite enough to open the window and vomit outside rather than in the room. But,
I don't think he sees it that way. But on the other hand, that was in 1972, and I don't know, he texted me yesterday, so it couldn't have been too bad.
Right. So us social scientists love random roommate assignment because it actually helps us answer one of the fundamental questions in social life, which is how do our peers and friends influence us? Part of the problem with most research on this topic is that, you know, you look at friend A as a heavy drinker, friend B as a heavy drinker. Maybe there's a little bit of a lag between when one person drinks and the other. But so you can't really assume that person A is drinking causing person B to drink because, you know what, they didn't just get randomly thrown together. They found each other. They're probably the heavy – they were already – had proclivities to be heavy drinkers, and they just are selecting into their friendship. But in with random roommates, we really know that it's just the luck of the draw that you got a binge drinker or you were the binge drinker for your roommate or whatever, or you have somebody of a different race or you have somebody who really excelled in high school or somebody who just squeaked into the college or what have you. And it allows us to study the effects of that person on their peer, i.e. their roommate, without the other problems that go with most friendship studies. And what we found, we collectively, is that roommates really do have a big influence on you. A binge drinker is much more likely to induce their roommate to start drinking or to have binge events as well. The pre-college grades of your roommate are going to affect your college GPA. And even your racial attitudes will be shaped if you're matched with a non-same-race roommate. And that's really interesting to know that our peers affect us that deeply. However, I can see why for individuals or parents that would create a lot of anxiety. You don't want to be the one who's with the person who's doing the tequila every other night or who ends up with a college roommate who's not very bright and kind of drags them down with them. So given that we know that these pure effects do exist, yes, there are real stakes in who you get, but I still think that the pluses of learning how to deal with any sort of person that you end up having to share a small space with is a lifelong lesson that outweighs any risk that you might have.
All right. We're going to be taking a break in just a second here. We do want to thank Dalton Conley from NYU for talking to us about this. We're going to grab a call here, too. But before we do that, Susan Salisbury, Director of Residential Life at Trinity College, I want to go back to you for a second and say, obviously, there are a number of different stakeholders in any kind of situation like this. You've got roommate one, you've got roommate two, you've got however many roommates there are. But you've also got their parents, and, you know, in some cases, parents these days, too. You have helicopter parents who are really worried about this. And as Dalton Conley is suggesting, too, there are insidious influences that we can have on one another. And it isn't even just tequila. It could be video games. You could, you know, you could wind up rooming with a gaming freak who lures you into a deep focus on Halo as opposed to Sociology 101. And then you've got parents sort of freaking out about that, too. You must be sort of like a UN negotiator or something a lot of the time.
You put that very well, the negotiator. We do receive many calls from very concerned parents, whether they're helicopter or Velcro parents. And one of the our goals is to educate parents as well. And we try to start at the very beginning with when we're talking to the parents and explaining what our role is, and that is to teach their children how to cope and how to learn from the experience of rooming with people that are different from them.
Let's grab one call here before break from Josie in New Haven. I want to say, if you want to talk about different points along the roommate experience continuum from your college days, maybe through your young adult days and perhaps even beyond, our number is 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. You may tweet us at WNPR Colin. Hi, Josie.
Hi, Colin.
What have you got to tell us about?
Well, unfortunately, it seems that even after your college days, you still run into roommate problems. I'm 30. I have three roommates. But a couple years ago, I was in a situation with some other roommates. And, you know, like, we chose this one roommate. She seemed really cool. And then almost a year later, she just started getting more and more irritable until the point where she actually came into my room when I was sleeping one night and hit me in the face 5 times.
Oh, my Lord.
Yeah.
Well, how do you
I ended up getting arrested.
Oh, my Lord.
Yep.
All right. So that's like the plot of Single White Female or one of those horror movies where your roommate becomes
evil.
The funny
is that I never had that experience in college.
Yeah.
It was not until I was like 27, 28.
That's because of the outstanding work done by your director of residential life in college. All right. Listen, we got to take a little break here. We'll come back with more roommate talk. We are going to sort of look a little bit further along the age continuum with our next two guests.
Makes noise at night on purpose.
What are some positive memories you have from living with roommates?
I'd probably say the camaraderie, you know, just kind of getting to know new people.
I remember staying up till 4 a.m. watching cartoons with a college roommate. It was the best day ever, and we stayed up all the way till 5, 6 a.m., then went to the college dining hall and ate donuts.
Just the good company, the camaraderie, that was the good part. That was the good part. That was about it.
And what are some of the negative memories you have?
Sharing a bathroom, people not always being as tidy as you would like them to be.
My first roommate in college, we and I did not get along very well, and we had very different lifestyles.
I've never had a negative experience with a roommate. I'm the most perfect roommate you'll ever meet. If you're looking to have a roommate, email John from West Hartford.
I don't know how you would actually do that, email John from West Hartford, but he sounds like a wonderful roommate. We're talking about roommates today. Susan Salisbury is with us. She's Director of Residential Life at Trinity College in Hartford. And joining us in just a second will be Richard Fry from the Pew Research Center and Derek Thompson, Senior Editor at The Atlantic. Before we go to those guys, let me just pick up one call here that I think is more up Susan's alley. So before we get in there, this is Tony in New Milford. Hi, Tony.
Hi. When my son went to college in the late 90s, he went to Maine, in the college in Maine, and they had a substance-free dorm for him because he didn't drink, and he didn't want to be bothered by drunk roommates. And he was also on some medication that he had to be careful of.
I'm
wondering if that's common today, if there are more of these dorms.
This is an interesting point. Yeah. Susan, maybe you can say a little bit about special dorms.
Yes, we do. And you will find today that many colleges do have a wellness residence hall. We do offer that for both our first-year students and upper class. We do dedicate residence halls for those that want to live in a substance-free environment.
I mean, the reality is, I think this is true anyway, this is, seems intrinsically, inherently true to me, that if you put somebody with good habits in a room with somebody with bad habits, the bad habits are going to win more often than the good habits. You know, hardly anybody sort of gives up drinking because their roommate doesn't drink. However, the other way, you know. So anyway, it may make some sense, depending on what your desired outcome is, to do things this way. We want to sort of fast forward a little bit across the age spectrum here and talk about how this plays out among millennials who are no longer in college. So we're going to start out with Richard Fry. He's a senior research associate at Pew Research Center. He has recently published a study about where America's young adults are living. Welcome to the show. And you know, in some ways, the headlines that first came out of this study, Richard Fry, had more to do with how many millennials were still living with their parents, right?
Yes.
But if you peel that back a little bit, there was some interesting information about how many millennials were continuing with a sort of platonic roommate experience well beyond college. Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, the you introduced it well, and we sort of traced it all the way back, living arrangements back to 68. And sort of the clear pattern is that millennials are much, much less likely to be married than similarly aged young adults back in 68. In 68, basically about 60% of 18 to 31-year-olds were either a husband or a wife. Today, only about 25% of millennials are married. And so the other sort of living arrangement you might look at is living alone. That's not markedly up. So marriage is way down. Living alone is markedly up. And so we also – it's only really recently that this business about living at home, failure to launch, is really up. And so in that void, we have living arrangements other than marriage alone and living with parents. That includes cohabitating with someone or living with a roommate or as a boarder. And so you are right that as young adults sort of delay marriage, the arrangement of – either living with an unmarried partner or living with roommates has sort of taken up the void, and that has largely grown.
And I don't know how possible it was to study this, but I'm also assuming a little bit of pressure on that statistic comes from the rise of living costs and the downturn in the economy. I'm assuming post-2008, the chances are that you're in your 20s and you can afford a place of your own, even if you want one, have deteriorated somewhat.
Yeah, I'm real comfortable with this idea that declining employment and declining earnings plays a real important role in the context of, you know, since the Great Recession, since 2007, 2008. You know, in the longer haul, though, sort of going, sort of thinking about the long-run trend, I'm not sure, you know, sort of how much the changing economics has to do with it. It's clearly, you know, has to do with it sort of the last 5-6 years. But this sort of decline in marriage and increased in other kinds of living arrangements, again, I've been pointing that this is, you know, this is a 4-decade trend.
Derek Thompson, you wrote about this in The Atlantic. What interested you about this trend?
What interested me really was that it appeared like roommates had essentially replaced married partners, spouses, in the last 50 years. You know, when I graduated from college, I moved in with roommates. Everybody that I knew essentially moved in with roommates. Very few of my friends, you know, were married when they were 22, 23. And this is rather common because, as Richard, you know, put it, you know, the marriage, the average marriage age has steadily crept up in the last 50 years. And there's all sorts of interesting reasons why. And so as a result, you've had fewer people living with their spouses and more living with roommates. And in a really remarkable degree, the popularity, the mainstreaming of of the roommate is an incredibly recent phenomenon. We take it as commonplace that somebody in their lower 20s, after they graduate from school, if they're not still living at home to save money, is going to move into an apartment with a roommate that they know from college or high school or Craigslist. And this is an incredibly recent arrangement. In 1968, just 6%, 1 in 16, of young people between 18 and 31 lived with platonic roommates, according to this Pew Research study. And that just struck me as an astonishing fact, and I just wrote sort of a piece acknowledging it and thinking about some reasons why.
And one of the things you also did, Derek Thompson, was kind of open it up to discussion on the comment section of your piece and asked whether anybody else had any other ideas why. The comment section kind of bogged down into an argument among two or three people. But did you, in terms of the feedback you got, you did ask your readers, you know, what are you seeing here? What kind of trends are you seeing here? Did you get anything back that interested you?
Sure. I think Richard is right. I think that the most important trend here is that young people are delaying marriage. It's not that marriage is in outright structural decline overall, but it is true that in the 1960s we had an enormously high married rate, marriage rate in our lower 20s, and that's changed a lot. And it's changed, I think, for two big reasons. One is that women are going to college much more than they were. I think the college matriculation rate among women has tripled in the last 50 years, and that's a huge deal because women are essentially are fully fledged members of the workforce now, and they don't need to rely on getting married to men when they're 22 in order to survive in the world. At the same time, I think that birth control, the normalization of the pill, has been shown in a lot of different studies to have given women the confidence to essentially invest in themselves, and that's another reason why we might see marriage rates ticking up. And as marriage has declined among 20-somethings, you have to live with somebody. As Richard said, living alone isn't much more popular today than it was 50 years ago. And so if that person's not your spouse, then it's very likely to be either someone that you're seeing or somebody who's just a platonic friend or a stranger that you've met from Craigslist.
You know, Richard Fry, he used the term confidence. But another way to look at this, of course, is that there's a decline in confidence, that somehow or other this roommate situation, which seems more provisional somehow, it's an extension of something rather than a leaping into something else, might result from some decline in confidence about the institution of marriage.
Sure, absolutely.
Derek, let me go to Richard on this first, and then I want to hear what you have to say too. But Richard, you start this off.
Yeah, I would say in terms of sort of survey evidence, I can't sort of point any direct survey evidence. Sort of, the work out of Andy Cherland sort of suggests that, it's not that young adults don't aspire and esteem to marriage. It's just that there's been sort of a real sort of shift in sort of it's viewed as sort of a capstone sort of arrangement. You need to get many other sort of things set up before you're willing to make that commitment economically. Whereas as opposed to that, sort of young adults 40, 50 years ago, they were much more willing in their early 20s to go ahead and make the commitments when they still sort of were, before they had leapt into their career and sort of gotten other facets of their lives sort of put together. So again, I wouldn't say, I think the evidence is it's not that they don't aspire to marriage, it's just that they view it as the end of a process rather than more at the start of the journey.
You know, Derek Thompson, we talked about the way in which the economy, the bad economy, declining employment and declining wages may create an atmosphere where these kinds of extended roommate arrangements are more popular, more necessary. But you sort of wonder, listening to him talk, listening to Richard Fry talk, about whether or not this phenomenon is kind of self-perpetuating on the economy. In other words, if you delay your entrance into marriage longer, there are certain kinds of economic decisions that you make later as a result. And I kind of wonder, in terms of a consumer economy, whether in fact part of the slowdown is, at least there's maybe a tail caused by this, a tail to the slowdown, a T-A-I-L, tail to the slowdown, caused by this, the fact that people are moving slower in general about decisions that do trigger certain kinds of spending.
I think you're asking exactly the right question. I think that, we've seen all sorts of markers of adulthood move back, not only getting married, but having kids, buying a house, buying a car, moving out of a parent's, your parents' basement. And I think that, a couple things that I mentioned are major drivers of a consumer economy, buying houses and buying cars, which comes with forming a household, forming a family, getting married. These things are being delayed. And I think that Richard is right, that a part of this is cyclical, a part of that is the Great Recession, but a big part of it is structural. People are going to school longer, and that's a happy story. It's wonderful that a larger share of millennials are getting education than any generation that came before us. That's good, given everything that we know about how college attainment confers benefits to wages, makes our workforce more productive, and all sorts of wonderful things. At the same time, it delays a lot of markers of adulthood, and those markers of adulthood have economic consequences. We want people to buy homes and buy cars, and fewer young people are. And so you might simply see that these big ticket industries, the real estate industry and the auto industry, are simply just going to have to get used to waiting. They're going to have to get used to waiting to first-time buyers being not 22 and 23, but rather 28 and 29.
Let me grab a quick call here. I got to pop Derek on hold for a second so I can take a call from Brian in Middletown. Hi, Brian.
Hi. I was just wondering if your panelists had any thoughts on whether this extended roommate thing or delayed marriage had anything to do with a culture of childism, that is a fear that children present, or having children presents only a burden with no concomitant benefits. And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, I'll start. I'm going to go back to Derek on this in a second, but let me just start with the demographer, with Richard Fry. So he's asking a question which, if you don't know the answer, I bet you're dying to know the answer. You know, what this millennial generation thinks about the whole issue of raising a family.
I think in general there is a lot of media coverage to sort of the costs of children and not the benefits. But it was kind of interesting. A Pew survey that we did a couple of years ago sort of asking sort of what you value. And sort of the headline of that was that millennials actually value parenthood more than they do marriage. In other words, we said, you know, do you want to be a good parent or do you want to be a good spouse? And actually more millennials said they wanted to be a good parent than to be a good spouse. And so I don't necessarily think that there's real strong evidence that the millennial generation sort of necessarily has a different attitude or greater fears of parenthood.
Yeah, and I'm wondering, Derek, too, whether it's more, and maybe we don't have the surveys to answer this, more a question of wanting to do all of these things right. In other words, previous generations may have grown up with the idea that, yeah, you got to get married, you got to get a house, you got to get a car, you got to start having kids on a certain schedule. The clock is ticking, get going. And whether the millennials kind of step back from all this and say, wow, we just see a lot of mistakes scattered across the plain here. Maybe it makes sense to stay with roommates for, you know, 4 or 5 years longer until I figure some of this stuff out.
Right. You know, if I could read the minds of 86 million millennials, that would certainly make my job a lot easier. But I have no idea why certain families aren't having kids at an earlier age. I do think it's true, though, that you look around the world, right, and every single advanced economy is having fewer children per marriage. In this, we see this in Europe. We see it in Asia. We're seeing it in the Western Hemisphere. And you know, one thing that correlates with that, to go back to one of the points I brought up earlier, is female education. And there's absolutely correlation between the number of post-secondary years that the average woman in that country has and having fewer kids. And so this simply might be the marker of an advanced economy where essentially you have both the husband and the wife who tend to want to work, that creates less time left over to take care of kids. And if you can't afford a babysitter, obviously there's some extremely wealthy, extremely productive couples that have 5 and 6 kids, and that's wonderful too, and every family can make its own decisions. But we're talking about a global trend here, and that global trend is the richer your country is, the more likely couples are going to have 2 or fewer children.
All right. I want to thank Derek Thompson very much. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he oversees business coverage on theatlantic.com. Richard Fry, Senior Research Associate for the Pew Research Center. I want to tell you what's going to happen for the rest of the show, too. First of all, we're talking about roommates. We do want to get your phone calls in at 860-275-7266 about your roommate experience. If you have college roommate questions, maybe even a pressing situation right now, we still do have the Director of Residential Life at Trinity College in Hartford, 860-275-7266. But you're also going to hear from roommates who've made it last for 18 years, which is, of course, longer than many, many marriages. Give us a call, though, 860-275-7266.
He flicks them on the rug. It's so disgusting. I hate my roommate. I hate my roommate.
replaced my old roommate with an Egyptian guy who's older than I am and doesn't really help out all that consistently with the rent or anything else, but he's very quiet and he doesn't touch any of my stuff. He's a mummy, technically, but we get along great. Today's show was produced by Patrick Scahill, Betsy Kaplan, and me, with help from our interns, Tess Aronson and Jonathan Scranton. The part of Bill Curry was played by Jennifer Jason Lee. On tomorrow's show, should tipping be abolished? And who picks up the check these days? New restaurant rules. And now, back to Colin.
All right, and we are talking about roommates today. We welcome your phone calls, 860-275-7266. Many of you are calling in. So David, Neela, Josh, Miriam, we will get to all of you, but we want to introduce you to some new guests here. They are joining us from the studios of NPR NY. They are, as I say, they're the people who really made this work, made it work longer than many marriages do. I'm going to screw up this name, but Shai Tara Gunsadit and Danny Dempsey are two of the four men living in what they call Fortress Astoria, which was profiled last year in the New York Times. Welcome, men of Fortress Astoria.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So maybe one of you could just sort of give us, in a nutshell, your story. Am I correct that you have been – it's probably more than 18 years now. I'm probably going from last year's New York Times figure. How long have you guys been together?
Since 1995, I guess.
And I'm assuming, and I know that it's been in more than one location, I'm assuming, you know, sort of early roommate stuff. Roommate 101 is don't leave your stuff lying around, change the toilet paper when you use it all up. So you guys must be at roommate 707 right now. I mean, I assume those kinds of things that roommates typically have to work out, you guys worked out ages ago?
We like to work on our fundamentals, so we go over the 101 course repeatedly. Yeah.
And when all else fails, just revert to apathy, and that really works
well.
Yes,
it's a free market roommate situation we're in.
So do you feel as though you have some kind of special temperament that has made this possible, or could just about any set of roommates have done what you did?
No, I think it does take a specific kind of chemistry, a sort of not laid-backness, but an acceptance of other people's foibles and some recognition of your own. More or less. It just worked out that the four of us get along in that way. We don't get into each other's way too much. We support each other when it's really needed. And if something bothers us, then we bury it deep inside and let it fester like any other red-blooded American.
And now, some of you were about to turn 40 or maybe even have turned 40 since the New York Times article. Do I have that right?
Actually, we all – the last of us just turned 40 on August 25th. So,
right.
Yep.
We had a big barbecue karaoke party to celebrate.
And so there are some people who look at this and go, wow, well, that feels – that looks to me from the outside – this is some imaginary person talking – like some kind of really protracted, extended college experience that just kind of keeps going and going. And you guys are creative people. You're fun people. You're having this great time. But there must be some people look at you and go, wow, well, they're still kind of – they've got their foot on the brake a little bit about certain kinds of plunges into adulthood. What's your reaction to that?
It's funny how much people sort of project their own situation and experience onto us. The fact that matters, we're sort of just really just living together, and it works out because we're friends. But it's neither an extended college experience nor sort of codependent.
Yeah, I think the thing is it's always been one of those things when like the lease renewal or something comes up, it's always been just sort of a thing of like, well, are we in a place where we should move on or whatever? And it just so happened that as of up to this point, the way we've all developed has happened to lead to us staying together to this point. Now, how long it lasts, who knows?
You know, I've got a bunch of people who are calling up right now and a lot of people who are listening who are either about to enter roommate situations or trying to cope with the roommate situation right now. And you guys now sort of have emerged as these bodhisattvas of the roommate experience. And I know there was even talk of maybe a reality TV show and stuff like that. But are there sort of pieces of wisdom that you have acquired over the years that you're capable of passing on to other people struggling with the roommate experience?
I think it depends on what the people involved. A lot of times it just comes down to being able to manage interpersonal relationships, I think, and being able to accept, you know, what's going on and be able to talk about it or you know, deal with it in one way or another.
I think that's mainly the thing. Like any relationship, you have to be open to communicate, but then you have to know which things you have to just let go and which things are more about yourself than anything your roommate is doing to possibly bother you.
Does either of you have an example of that, something that somebody else does that you've managed to let go?
Oh, man, there were things all along. Like before I even moved in, I know dishwashing was an issue out there. And, you know, I leave projects out. Some people would clean more than others. There's always little things, but it tends to balance itself out in the end.
I'm going to grab some calls here. A lot of people suddenly calling in want to talk about this. And as I say, we have all kinds of people waiting, standing by to give you advice if you feel like you need it. We still have Susan Salisbury. She's Director of Residential Life at Trinity. And we have the Bodhisattvas of the Roommate Experience, the guys from Fortress Astoria.
Well, I'm having cards made up with that now.
Yeah, absolutely. Here's Nella in West Hartford. Hi, Nella.
Hi. How are you?
Well, how are you?
We're okay. So I live in a bit of a co-op house share situation that we all, there's four of us, ranging from 23 to 29, and we all opted to live in this house where we have common goals, and we serve as a bit of a community center, but we also live here.
Hey, Nella, your phone is sort of cutting in and out. Is there something there you go. Oh, you sound so much better.
So we all opted to live in this living situation, but our ages range from just out of college to pushing 30.
Mm-hmm.
and we had a constitution before we moved in. We had these goals. We're actually watched by a national organization that we're part of. And I guess what we struggle with is we are very much like siblings, where we're very empathetic and we love each other very much. And some of us knew each other for 6 years. Some of us just met before we moved in. We have trouble sticking to the rules that we set. As a foursome, and then all these people that kind of float in and out of our house as our friends. How we communicate with each other is also rough. We don't want to ruffle feathers. We want to present as a happy family. But it's really, really difficult when one of us has to get up at 6 and the other one doesn't have to get up till noon, and there's parties and there's social stuff. Who's going to take up the garbage? Nobody looks at the chore board. How do you make it work and still be a happy family?
All right. These are great questions. And before I sort of throw them out not discard them, but did I understand you to say that you have a constitution?
We do. We're part of the national organization of house shares that we get funding from community members. And in exchange, we put on programming for our age group, which is, you know, post-college, pre-marriage, which is, you know, we are specifically designed for those people who are just floating around, but we live here and we put on social programs, educational programs as part of our rent subsidy.
All right, this is amazing stuff. First of all, throw it over to the Fortress Astoria guys. I would imagine the idea of a written constitution would be anathema to you. But she asks a good question. Sort of how do you get everybody to sort of stick to the agreements, formal or informal, that you've made?
That's the thing. The only agreements we have are pay your rent and pay your bills on time at this point. And you know, wash your dishes. That's about it.
Yeah. I mean, everyone just has to be a little bit conscientious of each other. And, like, I get up at 4:30 in the morning a lot. One thing is I'm a pretty sound sleeper. But, I mean, the other thing is that people are pretty good about, you know, like, we had a thing where one of my roommates wanted to throw a party. I had to get up the next day for class. And we just sort of negotiated a situation where I'm probably going to be going to stay the night at
my girlfriend's place. He's
yes.
going to go sleep at my girlfriend's place while we're at the party at our apartment.
Yeah.
This is a lot of moving parts. Well, you know, let me just throw this over to Susan Salisbury, because this is also the question that Nella was asking is just a great one, and one that you have to deal with too, right? Roommates may initially agree to certain ways of living, but then how do you stick to that, and how do you deal with those situations?
Well, what we have is an entire staff of mediators. We sit down with groups and we will help students draw up roommate contracts. Mm. What we have, which the housemates might not have, is we do have rules and policies of the college. Mm. And we can remove you from housing if you you know, continually break policy and all. But we mediate. We, you know, do whatever we can to help them talk about it and communicate.
Right. So if you're getting up at 4:30 in the morning, you could probably hit one of your roommates in the face five times while they're asleep, and they would never even know who did it. All right. We had an earlier call about that. Let's go to Josh in Farmington, I think, who's about to embark on this experience. Hi, Josh.
Hi. Love the show. I'm 23 years old, just fresh out of college. In college, I lived in a condo with my girlfriend and one of my friends. And recently, we got in a fight and moved out, and I learned a lot. And now I'm moving into a house, a two-family house with six guys.
Ooh.
Yeah. And I like what your guest said earlier about when in doubt, just kind of go with apathy. And that I found myself towards the end of my time in college living with my friend and my girlfriend, I found myself getting towards this kind of just apathetic state. Where I would just say, you know, I just don't care anymore that you're leaving a mess every day. I just don't care anymore that, you know, we have all our friends coming in and out. Because we had a contract earlier when we first moved in. And I realized that that didn't really work. And now this time with the six guys, we don't really have that now. And we're just kind of have this, you know, our rules are pay your bills and don't touch anyone's stuff.
Well, you know, I just let me go back to the Fortress Astoria guys, because first of all, when in doubt, just go with apathy would be a great T-shirt, and someone should, you know, license it right now. On the other hand, I don't know how serious you really were about that. I mean, there's a kind of enervation that goes along with that that may not be ultimately desirable.
Well, I mean, the fact is we all just crossed the 40-year-old mark, so there's a certain level of maturity that one hopes comes along with that, and self-discipline to not just leave stuff all over the place or invade your roommate's privacy. But yeah, I mean, if something is really bothering you, you should probably bring it up. Apathy is just going to I joked about it earlier, but it's just going to fester underneath, and you're going to get very angry and spend a lot of time in your room closing doors harder than they need to be closed. So just talk about it in a calm and rational manner, and hire a cleaning person.
The other thing, though, that Chai did bring up, though, is to usually before you bring something up to other people, you might want to look and see whether that's something that is really something that should be bothering you, or if it's something that maybe it's just coming up because it's an issue of your own that you are like throwing out on somebody rather than just being something that is actually something that, you know, you couldn't live with.
Right.
Susan has been nodding emphatically throughout most of this, but I mean, I assume that is a part. You have such vast experience now with so many different roommate combinations, but one of the probably consistencies is just shutting up and taking it probably isn't a good idea for the reasons that they're saying, right? It festers, it comes out, ultimately is something a lot worse.
Well, again, our students are there for 9 months, and they know that at the end of those 9 months, they will be able to move out. They'll be able to choose other roommates. And so there are students who'll say, I'm just going to live with it. You know, I can deal with it until next year. But one of the points that the gentleman brought up is, are there other issues? And that definitely is something that will come up with many roommate conflicts, that it isn't anything about the fact that my roommate won't go to sleep when he should. There's definitely something else going on.
You know, we've only got about 30 seconds left, and I'm always sorry when I put somebody on for 30 seconds because it goes longer. But, David, is there a way that you could, in fact, say what you want to say in, say, now 20 seconds?
Well, I found the comment earlier about whether a roommate situation is the beginning of a journey or the ending of a capstone moment. And for myself, my wife and I never dated before I asked her to marry. And we've been together over 25 years, and it's been the best roommate situation imaginable. But only possible because we both had dozens and dozens of roommates. We knew each other. And my comment to a friend who thought I was absolutely crazy.
So this makes a lot of sense. I don't mean to cut you off, but we're sort of out of time. And it suggests that the Fortress Astoria guys are going to be fabulous spouses. They've had so much training, so we can't wait for that. Thanks to everybody who helped out with today's show. If I said all your names, I'd be out of time, but Susan Salisbury is here with me in the studio. Thanks to her. Thanks to the Fortress Astoria guys. Everybody else who contributed.
I'm Kyone Wolf. I'm pretty excited. I think I found a roommate that's really going to work. How's it going, Darth?
If you only knew the power of the dark side.
I totally do. It's nice to live with somebody who understands you should turn the lights off when you leave a room, you know?